This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Believe it or not, some, if not most, schools across the country have entire departments dedicated to nothing but playing games. These games are called sports, and they seem to be pretty popular. But seriously now, as we begin another college and professional football season, there's still a lot of talk of how to rid the sports world of performance-enhancing drugs. All of the college and major sports leagues in the U.S. have drug testing programs, but how exactly do those programs work?
For anti-doping organizations that are signatories to the World Anti-Doping Code, the testing menu is defined by the prohibited list that is part of the code.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll take a look at drug testing programs in sports from the point of view of the scientists who conduct them. We'll also spend an academic minute finding out how much it costs to hire a smoker. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Another baseball season was soiled with talk of steroids and other performance-enhancing drugs, and now that the college and pro football seasons are cranking up, the doping talk will doubtless start going into overdrive, too. Despite the best efforts of sports leagues, players still look for an advantage in a bottle or a pill, and scientists are working hard to keep up with the latest in so-called designer steroids and other drugs. Today we thought we'd give you a look at the drug testing process from the point of view of the scientists and the chemists who designed the tests rather than the drugs. Dr. Anthony Butch is the director of the Olympic Analytical Laboratory and the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at UCLA. And Dr. Larry Bowers is the chief science officer for the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency in Colorado Springs. We started out by asking Dr. Butch why the topic of doping in sports is getting so much attention.
I think that sports doping has gained widespread attention because over the last several years, there have been athletes with highly successful careers that have been caught doping and were banned from competition. This makes sports doping difficult to ignore, especially in light of recent comments by professional athletes suggesting or acknowledging that doping is a problem in sports. The public used to believe that highly successful athletes were winners because of their God-given talents and solid work ethic. Now, people are unsure if it is talent and hard work that produces winners or the use of performance-enhancing drugs that provide the competitive edge to make them winners.
Can you walk us through the testing process?
Sure. The testing process begins with a collection of samples, which occurs by collection agencies that are separate from the laboratories. Athlete samples, mostly urine samples, are shipped to the laboratory and typically arrive 1 to 2 days after collection. From the moment the samples arrive in the laboratory, chain of custody procedures are implemented to document the whereabouts of the samples in the laboratory and who or what has physical custody of the samples at all times. Chain of custody is established for the original urine containers and all aliquots that are prepared for analysis. The laboratory typically receives 2 bottles of urine from each athlete, which are labeled A and B bottle. The bottles are checked for leakage and signs of tampering. Since only the A bottle is used for the initial testing, the B bottle is not opened and is stored in a locked freezer. The specific gravity and pH of the A bottle urine is determined to identify signs of sample adulteration and the presence of a liquid other than urine. Depending upon the testing menu, up to 5 or more urine aliquots can be prepared for testing. A few hormones, such as human chorionic gonadotropin and luteinizing hormone, can be measured by simply placing the urine onto an automated instrument without any sample pretreatment. However, the majority of testing requires a cleanup step to extract the compounds of interest from the urine matrix and remove interfering substances. For this, either solid phase or liquid phase extraction methods are used for sample cleanup, depending upon the class of compounds in the screen. After extraction, samples are then dried down to concentrate the material and reconstituted with a small amount of solvent. The samples are then placed on the autosampler of either a gas chromatography mass spectrometer or a liquid chromatography tandem mass spectrometer for detection of specific compounds. Instrument run times for each sample range from a few minutes up to 30 minutes, depending on the class of compounds being monitored. Standards containing peer reference compounds are analyzed with each batch of unknown urine samples for comparison. The collected data are reduced to dedicated windows containing specific time periods and mass-to-charge ions that correspond to the expected elution times and mass spectrum for each target compound. Several mass-to-charge ions are typically monitored to identify each drug. Each screen for a class of prohibited substances takes approximately 2 days to complete, from sample aliquoting to the reporting of negative results. If a urine sample screens positive for a prohibited substance, then another aliquot of urine is removed from the A bottle and is tested a second time by itself with only the appropriate standards and urine controls. The confirmation test is usually designed to have greater specificity for the drug of interest than the screening test. If the confirmation test confirms the presence of the prohibited substance identified during the screen, the A sample is then considered positive. The athlete can request testing of the B bottle for additional confirmation that prohibited substance is present and also has the right to witness the opening of the B bottle and observe the entire testing procedure.
Okay, now how does an anti-doping laboratory know which substances to test for?
For anti-doping organizations that are signatories to the World Anti-Doping Code, the testing menu is defined by the prohibited list that is part of the code. The prohibited list is updated on a yearly basis, and new compounds are continually being added to the list. The most current prohibited list can be found on the World Anti-Doping Agency website. For out-of-competition testing, the prohibited list includes anabolic agents, peptide hormones such as erythropoietin and growth hormone, beta-2 agonist, hormone antagonists and modulators, diuretics, and masking agents. To give you an idea about the number of drugs being tested, the exogenous anabolic steroid list alone contains 49 specific compounds. For in-competition testing, more classes of compounds are prohibited besides those on the out-of-competition prohibited list. Stimulants, narcotics, cannabinoids, and glucocorticoid steroids are also prohibited in competition. Beta blockers can also be prohibited depending upon the sport. This involves a lot of additional drug testing. As an example, there are currently 64 stimulants on the prohibited list that World Anti-Doping Agency accredited laboratories are expected to routinely screen for during in-competition testing.
Dr. Butch, are all doping control programs the same, or are there differences?
Doping control programs are not all the same when it comes to drug testing. If the doping control organization follows the World Anti-Doping Code, then the compounds monitored are all the drugs on the World Anti-Doping Prohibited List and would be the same for all doping organizations following the code. This means that the list of banned substances for Olympic athletes in the United States would be identical to the list used for Olympic athletes in other countries. This ensures a level playing field. However, there are many sports organizations that have not signed onto the World Anti-Doping Code for many different reasons. This includes professional, college, and high school sports organizations. They typically create their own list of banned substances that often includes some, but not all of the compounds on the World Anti-Doping Prohibited List. Anabolic steroids are usually prohibited and mirror the World Anti-Doping Prohibited List, but other classes of compounds, such as beta-2 agonists and glucocorticoid steroids, are usually not prohibited. Stimulants are usually prohibited, but the number of stimulants on the list is considerably smaller than the World Anti-Doping Prohibited List of stimulants. Another example is diuretics, which may not be routinely tested for unless the urine has a very low specific gravity and is extremely dilute.
Still to come, the Chief Science Officer for the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency will join the conversation. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1198. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guests today are Dr. Anthony Butch, the director of the Olympic Analytical Laboratory and the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at UCLA, and Dr. Larry Bowers, the chief science officer for the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency in Colorado Springs. And we'll get Dr. Bowers into the conversation right now. Doctor, what steps are anti-doping agencies taking to deter athletes from taking performance-enhancing drugs?
Well, as you've pointed out, the goal of any anti-doping program is deterrence. For those athletes that are struggling with a decision as to whether to use performance-enhancing drugs or not, it's really important that they see the risks and accountability for their behaviors. So we use a model that was developed in social science called the perceptual deterrence model or rational choice model. And according to that model, there has to be a perceived risk of being tested, a concern that the substance used is going to be detected, and an understanding that there'll be a significant consequence for breaking the rules. So just to use an everyday example, if we know there's no law enforcement for speed limits, drivers speed at will, pretty much. If there's an indication of a radar trap, all of the traffic slows down, even if the police car has a mannequin in it and no radar. But if we were to leave that fake trap at the same location for too long, people would notice and speeds would again increase because perceived risk would be low. Again, just to sort of finish the whole concept, if the fine for speeding was $5, no one would mind paying it even if you were caught. So there's really no deterrence. So the key to having an effective deterrence program is that we use intelligence, information that we can gather to guide our collections. Our laboratory testing must continue to develop through research so that we can detect all of the substances the athletes are using. And our sanctions have to be such that we maintain perceived risk. And as athletes change their behaviors in order to avoid detection, we have to also change our strategies in order to continue to have an effective risk of detection.
Some athletes have claimed they inadvertently ingested prohibited substances contained in dietary supplements. Now, how can an athlete avoid this possibility?
Well, first and foremost, athletes need to be informed consumers. They need to carefully review the products that they plan to take, to contact authorities and product manufacturers to get detailed information about substances that they're taking, and perhaps even have the product tested themselves. We usually advise athletes to exercise common sense and avoid products with suspicious names and exaggerated claims. For example, athletes should be cautious when they encounter marketing terms such as stacked or muscle, mass, trend, bowl, legal steroid, stimulant, and terms like that. In general, supplements that promise better sexual performance, more muscle, spectacular weight loss, and instant recovery should be suspect. To really put it most simply, if a supposedly safe supplement's benefits sound too good to be true, they probably are. Given the current regulatory framework and the fact that it can't ensure that a supplement is free of contaminants or that what is listed on the label is what the supplement actually contains, USADA continues to advise athletes to use supplements at their own risk.
Doctor, what are some strategies that are used to optimize the drug testing programs?
Well, a well-developed and effective anti-doping program is not based on testing alone. We must also focus on deterrence, education, a thorough and fair results management process, and timely and significant consequences. We also know that an effective drug testing program really has to contain year-round, no-notice testing in order to be effective. Research is a critical aspect of our work. We continually evaluate our collection strategies. We've learned over the years that cheaters change their behaviors in response to our improvements in testing. For example, when a urine test for recombinant erythropoietin was developed with a detection window of 7 days, the cheaters switched from subcutaneous injection to intravenous administration, specifically to reduce the detection window. Another important element is monitoring whether or not an athlete is using prohibited substances. We use the monitoring of intra-individual reference ranges, which is sometimes called the athlete biological passport in sports, to identify non-physiological changes in blood or urine analytes. For example, each urine we collect is tested for a number of steroid concentrations, and those concentrations are analyzed for deviations from that person's previous tests. And by doing that, we can narrow the range of variability before we can detect a clear case of doping. The same is true for collection of hematological parameters like hematocrit, reticulocytes, and so on. Again, the intra-individual changes are much smaller than population changes, which is well known in clinical chemistry. And we use that same principle to follow up on individuals within the anti-doping testing pool. Usually, but not always, abnormal results would be used to perform additional strategic testing rather than evidence in a particular doping case.
And doctor, other than drug testing, what have doping programs done to enhance their ability to catch and deter athletes from using performance-enhancing substances?
Our testing program is highly effective, but we do understand that in order to be truly successful, we must continue to advance our intelligence gathering and our research efforts. It's clear that a single approach cannot be successful. In the fight against doping, it's critical that we remain vigilant. Any pattern that we establish, such as, for example, collecting no-notice out-of-competition samples at a particular time of day, or any rule that we write, can be used by the cheaters to undermine the process. We have to continue to use intelligence to understand what the athletes are doing and modify our test distribution plan and specific test allocation to catch cheaters and maintain deterrence. Research is really also a very important point. We have to be able to detect doping agents and methods and their unique effects on the body in order to achieve any level of deterrence. Any new doping substances and methods or changes in behavior due to new tests must continue to be researched. In this regard, the Partnership for Clean Competition, which is a research consortium formed by the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, the U.S. Olympic Committee, the National Football League, and Major League Baseball, is also a critical factor for the future. By the way, any clinical chemist or toxicologist is eligible to apply for a PCC research grant. The website is cleancompetition.org. And finally, it's important that we enhance the true value of sport and break the cycle of win at all cost that is the root of so many problems in our society. USADA has developed curricula that are in use in our elementary and high schools. USADA has conducted a survey on the value of sport, and we're working to develop educational programs based on the results of that survey. We need to create a culture of excellence and values rather than a culture of winning at all costs.
And finally, back to you, Dr. Butch. Based on your interviews, do you think athletes who are tested for performance-enhancing substances support anti-doping programs?
Yes, I do. I think that the majority of athletes truly believe that drug testing programs are an effective tool for preventing doping to gain a competitive edge. When an athlete is caught doping, I think that other athletes feel that this damages the integrity of the sport. Doping scandals make it harder for the public to believe that athletes are successful because of his or her natural abilities and not because they cheated by taking a prohibited compound. Many athletes believe that along with good educational programs that emphasize the health risks associated with doping, more unannounced random testing of athletes is needed to prevent the use of performance-enhancing substances.
Dr. Anthony Butch is the director of the Olympic Analytical Laboratory and the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at UCLA. And Dr. Larry Bowers is the chief science officer for the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency in Colorado Springs. They expanded on this topic in an article called The Quest for Clean Competition: Are the Testers Catching the Dopers? That was in the journal Clinical Chemistry.
Feel free. I want a new job.
Performance-enhancing drugs in sports is one thing, but there is another type of drug that is starting to be filtered out of the system. There are businesses around the country that have determined that hiring a smoker could be too costly. And that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. A pack-a-day habit costs the average American smoker about $2,000 per year. But the true costs don't stop there. Micah Berman, assistant professor of health policy and law at Ohio State University, reveals why employers can expect to see a portion of their profits go up in smoke when an employee lights up.
By reviewing and synthesizing previous studies, my co-authors and I sought to estimate the excess annual costs that a private sector U.S. employer could attribute to employing an individual who smokes tobacco as compared to a non-smoking employee. We constructed a cost estimation approach that consolidated discrete costs associated with tobacco smoking. While all of these discrete costs had been studied extensively in the past, in most cases they had never been converted into a projected annual cost for employers. We analyzed five factors: absenteeism, presenteeism, lost productivity due to smoking breaks, healthcare costs, and pension benefits. Presenteeism refers to lower on-the-job productivity due to a lack of attention, in this case, caused by short-term cycles of nicotine withdrawal. For each factor, we projected an annual cost using the best available data from previous studies. Overall, we estimated that each year, an employee who smokes costs an employer an average of $5,816 more than an employee who has never smoked. We caution that this is a rough indicator of excess costs, and the cost may vary significantly depending upon the industry, the specific employees, and numerous other factors. In our estimate, lost productivity due to smoking breaks accounted for just over half the projected costs. Healthcare costs were the next largest component, totaling more than a third of projected costs. Our study did not include all possible smoking-related costs and may therefore be an underestimate. Nonetheless, our study highlights that the costs relating to smoking are substantial, not just for those who use tobacco, but for their employers as well.
That was Micah Berman of Ohio State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.